I had the privilege today of calling and speaking with our with Amy F. tonight. She is from San Fernando Valley in the Pacoima Group, which I think is somewhere down near the L.A. region of California. She's had sponsors. Well, she's had a sponsor, and I know she's had many sponsees, and she's even been sober since November of 2002. That's a lot. That's a lot of days. So if we could all give a warm Valley Group welcome to Amy F. from San Fernando Valley. San Fernando Valley.
Thank you. That was awesome. I'm Amy. I'm an alcoholic. Let me look at my phone. I told Uncle Jim that I'm anxious about a lot of things, but time is one of them. So, and as my husband will tell you next week, because he's your speaker next week, that if I'm not cut off, I will just keep on talking forever. So thank you, Jim, for your call earlier. When he asked, I had never been to Pacoima before I got sober either. He asked, the best way I could describe it was, do you know Danny Trejo? Like, he's like their hometown hero. That's where he's from, you know? And I know I'm not breaking his anonymity when I say, like, that's where he got sober. And it's the Pacoima Group is my home group. It's been my home group for 18 years. And when I was very newly sober, my sponsor gave me a book called, like, The Importance of Choosing a Home Group, and I never read it. My sponsor and, I had the spiritual advisor, they used to give me, I find myself in these meetings sometimes, like, talking about these things that were given to me, and I swear to you, like, I never, and I'm not trying to, be an example, but I never, I'll talk about the book, and then I'll be like, oh, I never read that, I was a GSR for 2 years. I don't think I ever read the 12 concepts. But there's still time. There's still time for me to do that. I never read Dr. Bob, the Good Old Timers. Coming of Age. I read, Stephen King and Game of Thrones. That's the stuff I like. Anyway. So thank you, Jim, for that call. Thank you, Tammy. I don't think she's on here, so I'll thank Bill because I think Bill, passed my number along. It's people like Bill that really, tremendously helped me to stay sober because, of myself, I'm an alcoholic and I'm selfish and self-centered and, it's like I want my time. I've learned how to say yes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's people like Bill who present those opportunities for me. I like that you read From Working With Others, because working with others and carrying the message is part of it's part of the 12 steps. It's part of this design for living that I've committed myself to, that the thing that helps me to stay sober and be a better person and continue to try to be a better person and to get along with people in the world. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps do for me. It's not easy and it doesn't always feel good. But I've been, as Jim alluded to, I've been doing it for a long time and my life has gotten so much better. I didn't want any of it. I didn't want any of it when I was new. So, my sobriety date is November 15, 2002. Briefly, I can say today, after being sober and working the steps with a sponsor and, doing that inventory and coming to believe and then rely on a God of my understanding, that's the work. I can say today that I had a really amazing childhood. You know, if you would have asked me that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous or, you know, 10 years before that, I couldn't have given you that answer. You know, I've gotten, as I've gotten to, like, know myself a little better in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've gotten some perspective, you know, but it took a long time. So I had a really good life. You know, my parents were and are loving and generous and incredible people. They gave me everything, you know, and I appreciate it today because I have kids, you know, and I can't, you know, my husband and I, you know, we live a good life, but you know, we can't send our kids to private school. I went to a fancy French private school. I got to go on trips to Europe. I got to go to, you know, we had memberships to like the Opera House, and you know, we would, you know, I had this amazing just kind of cultural education, and I didn't appreciate any of it, and everything was a chore. My parents were kind and loving. I hated them, you know, for no reason. I mean, if I'm going to be honest, my parents are mixed race, and I went to these fancy schools with, like, all white people, so I looked different, so I felt different, and I probably, you know, really just blamed them for all of that. And then, you know, getting to be a grown-up and, you know, learning about, you know, because I was never interested in my parents' experience about anything, you know, but part of my amends, because they're the people that, like, really suffered the most from my selfish, you know, destructive, hideous, you know, alcoholic life. Part of my amends, showing up for them, you know, and getting to know them as people, you know, and getting to know them that, you know, it was brave for them to marry each other and to fall in love, you know, that their families weren't exactly on board, you know, and just, you know, those experiences. And I'm grateful that I have a chance to do that, you know. Sorry, it's never good when I, like, cry at the beginning. We moved to the Valley, the San Fernando Valley, when I was 14, so that's why I sound like this. Jim, when I was talking to Jim earlier, it was probably a longer conversation than he wanted to have because I'm a talker, and I remember he was saying he was trying to get out of work, and I'm, like, still talking. Sorry. I hope he got out of work early enough. I forgot what, oh yeah, I told him I never listened. He said this meeting was being recorded so I could listen to myself after, and I said I tried that one time and I couldn't get past like 5 minutes of me talking because I was like horrified. The sound of my voice is really annoying, and as maybe you're thinking to yourself right now. And then I was like, and I, you know, and then I was just like, no, this is so bad. So I'll never do that. But we moved to the Valley when I was 14. I went to high school out there. That is how old I was when I took my first drink. My first drink was my first drunk. 14. It was, before a homecoming dance. It was my first date with a boy ever. And, I, you know, made out with my date and puked and blacked out, and that's like the story, that's my whole drunkalogue. That's what happened to me every single time I drank, from my first drink to my last drink. Was I don't have any sushi. Oh, my kid's toy, sorry. I was a puking, blackout, makeout drunk. It wasn't hard for me to identify as an alcoholic, with, you know, who had lost control when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was never, appropriate when I drank, you know, and in high school, it wasn't all the time, but every time I drank, like, incredible, tragic, you know, things would happen, and I would screw friends over, or, you know, someone would have to take care of me, you know, because every single time I drank, I, you know, passed out. And, you know, my friends had to take care of me. And I was really lucky, you know, to have friends that would. And that's just, you know, and I, so every time I drank, you know, and I was the smart, and, you know, the consequences get worse, you know, as, you know, life responsibility, you know, you have to start becoming responsible. And I knew I was an alcoholic because I could not drink, and it was as simple as that. But just knowing that wasn't enough for me to stop drinking, you know. And what alcohol did for me initially, and not for very long, but what it did for me was I never felt okay. You know, I never, even though I can look back and see that everything looks good on paper. You know, I had friends, I got good grades, I had, you know, a nice house, I had nice parents, check. I never felt okay, you know, and my head was just a constant, like, is this okay? Am I okay? Is this okay? Am I okay? And it was just very uncomfortable. And what alcohol did for me initially was it gave me that relief, you know, that comes at once with that first drink. And I felt okay. I felt I could breathe. I felt I belonged here. You know, everything was okay. And I think that's what I was chasing. Like, I wasn't trying to, like, rocket into the fourth dimension. Like, I just wanted to feel okay, you know, because it was very hard to live in that, you know, what I guess I would call fear, you know. And I didn't know that until I had, you know, started to do the work in Alcoholics Anonymous, that, you know, if you would have asked me if I was fearful, I would have been like, no, you know. But I didn't know that fear was that, you know, it was that corrosive thread that ran through my life, that penetrated to me, like, me at my core, you know. And I think no wonder I reached for alcohol. It was the only thing that shut that thing up, and it was the only thing that gave me that relief, you know. And but my behavior was so inappropriate, which I think is a nice word to use that you know, I created a lot of wreckage, you know, and I couldn't keep it going. I couldn't keep it going at the rate I was going. You know, I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't a functioning alcoholic. I couldn't, you know, I remember when I was new, like, girls would come in. I got sober at a women's recovery home, which I guess I'll get to, but that some people would come in, some girls that would still have, like, husbands or cars or, like, nice purses, and I just didn't understand that. I couldn't have or keep anything, you know. And I couldn't keep a job, and when I couldn't keep jobs, and I couldn't not crash my car, I couldn't not get evicted, I was completely reliant on other people because I couldn't work, because I couldn't drive, because I couldn't function. And so towards the end of my drinking, like, relationships were that was my lifeline. You know, because I couldn't make my own money, and I couldn't take care of myself, and I needed to be in that relationship so that I could continue to have a place to sleep, and to have, you know, alcohol. And my behavior became so bad because, you know, I really relate to that Jekyll and Hyde alcoholic, you know, disgustingly, like all, you know, fine when you're sober. I've been totally paraphrasing, you know, like, oh, she's so nice or whatever when you're sober. And then just, like, disgustingly and dangerously antisocial, you know. And I was so, so nasty. And, and, like, the whole time I felt like, because that's not who I am, you know. And I had to learn that in Alcoholics Anonymous, that the things I did didn't define me. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a way to get past that, you know, so that I could move forward and live, you know. So because I felt bad for the things that I did, and deep down I knew the things I was doing was wrong, you know. I didn't feel good about saying horrible things to people that loved me. I didn't feel good about stealing from employers, you know. I didn't feel good about stuff like that. But alcohol helped to cover up all those feelings so that I could continue to drink until I couldn't, you know, until it stopped working, and it stopped covering up all that guilt and shame and disgust. I was so disgusted with myself because I feel like I was so set up you know, the circumstances of my life set me up so well. And I just, I sank so low, you know, and something inside me knew that it just, it wasn't supposed to be like that, you know, that I should be doing something better. So, but I couldn't, you know, and, you know, because I was an alcoholic and I had parents that cared about me, they started sending me to rehab. I went to my first, program when I was 24. It was, a 28-day program in Palm Desert, and, nothing wrong with that place. You know, it was a good place. It didn't work for me because I didn't want to stop drinking, you know. At that time, you know, I couldn't get a relationship, and I certainly couldn't keep it, you know. So my parents were like the last, you know, people on earth who would like take care of me and let me live in their home. And so it was like, you know, I had to stop drinking to live in their home. And so I went to this place, and you know, what I did for 28 days was like, eat frozen yogurt and play ping pong and fraternize. And I left that place, with a $40,000 big book on my parents' dime, and drank 4 days later, dragged them through some more pain and suffering, which ended in, you know, an ER. A lot of times, you know, my binges ended up in the ER. And I was in the ER, at the hospital where my mother worked. You know, my mom works in like microbiology, and it never occurred to me then, or, you know, probably like really, maybe I thought about it before, but, you know, thinking about it now, like how, you know, embarrassing that might have been for her, you know, because everyone that's in the computer knows, like, you know, patients and stuff like that. But after that debacle, they put me in a 90-day program in Simi Valley. It was a women's place, and I was good at complying, saying what I needed to say, because, you know, I had nowhere else to go, you know. And what I did for 90 days there was I fraternized, and I, you know, had like 3 boyfriends in 90 days, and some of them already had girlfriends and fiancés, because I had no principles before Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no concept of like other. And it still like blows my mind today that something was able to break through, you know, because I only could think about my needs, you know, and I needed alcohol, I needed money, I needed a ride, I need validation, you know, and so I took, you know, at the last recovery home I was at, you know, they used to, I mean, to me, but all us girls, they used to be like, you're just takers, you know, you're just a taker, you know, you take, 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 you need to learn how to give. And I understand it now, much better than I understood it then. And then I was just offended. You know, I took, you know, and, when I completed that 90-day program, I relapsed like that night. The guy I was seeing came and picked me up, and I drank, and then the only people I knew in Simi Valley were AA people. So I lived on the good graces of the nice AA people in Simi Valley. I, you know, rented their rooms. I, you know, raided their med cabinets. I, you know, came in late. I was disrespectful to their, you know, property. I did all those things, you know, and these people were so nice, and they took me to meetings, and they wanted to give me this gift, you know, before I was ready. And I'm grateful for those people. So what happened when alcohol stopped working for me, when it stopped covering up all those horrible feelings I had, I just couldn't live. I couldn't drink enough to not feel anymore. And all I felt were those feelings. And, in the big book, the part that like describes my experience like to a T is the jumping off place. And it says, you know, someday a man can't imagine life either with or without alcohol. Then he will know loneliness such as you do. He'll be at the jumping off place. He'll wish for the end. And that's exactly what happened to me. As I was living in Simi Valley, I couldn't drink. I had conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And what that meant was, like, I knew I was powerless over alcohol because I always knew that. I knew my life was unmanageable. I knew that too. But I knew that it meant that I couldn't drink anymore. You know, and I had been in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because I had been at rehab and I'd been going to meetings. But I didn't want that, you know. I wasn't one of those people that didn't believe you were happy, joyous, and free and sober and blah, blah, blah. I thought that was fine. And I didn't even think it was something that wouldn't work for me, you know, like, oh, that's good for you, it won't work for me. Like, even if it was going to work for me, I didn't want it. You know, I didn't want to live in a world where I couldn't drink. And I knew that I couldn't drink. You know, and so I made a decision, at the time I was dating my sponsor's stepson, and I was 27 and he was 19, and he, you know, it was like two bottles of wine into the night, and he dumped me. He was like, I love you, but you're crazy, and that's how all my relationships used to end. And it was, it was a dirt road in Simi Valley. He was driving. He dumped me. I did that thing where I was like, let me out of the car right now. And he did. And it was, I was on the road, you know, I had $60 in my pocket and I had a plan. You know, my parents who lived in Woodland Hills. I've been, since Zoom, I've been, getting to share in meetings kind of like all over. And I just realized like how, you know, California centric I am because I say all these towns and like probably nobody has any idea. And they're like, Simi Valley. But Woodland Hills is where my parents lived. It was like probably 30 to 40 minutes away from Simi Valley. Really has not important to the story. So I knew my parents were on vacation, so I knew that they weren't home. We had a dog at the time who had epilepsy. She took phenobarbital to treat that. I knew where the pills were because I also used to take them when my parents were still allowing me to live in the house. So I had $60 in my pocket and I had a plan. I didn't want to live in a world where I couldn't drink. And I very much didn't want to live in a world where I had to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. So I called a cab. They took me to my parents' house. I had to break in, because I was no longer welcome there. I climbed through the dog door. I remember, getting stuck. Because I remember thinking, like, how dare they? You know, how dare they make me break into my own house like a dog? You know? I always think of willing to go to any lengths when I think about that dog door because it's still there in their house. And it's so small. And, like, I always think, like, I don't even know if my head could get through now, you know? And I always think, like, oh, I should try and, like, freak my mom out. But I never do. But I eventually got into the house. I got to those pills. The bottle was almost full. I had a good plan. I took almost all of the pills. I remember leaving like 7 for the dog because that's who I was thinking about. I went downstairs, went to the den, took those pills, fully expected never to wake up again. And, God was working in my life before I acknowledged him or allowed him to, because my, brother who didn't live there, he was a grown up. And he had his own place. He was at the house that night. He called 911. I woke up in ICU however many days later. And, my first thought was, F you, God. And I didn't have a relationship with God before Alcoholics Anonymous. I believed in God because I was raised a certain way. But we didn't have a relationship. You know, I mean, I can tell you exactly where we parted ways. I dropped out of confirmation. And, it was like, you know, there's God and his people and me and smart people, and that's the way it's going to be, you know. But I love in We Agnostics where it says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, because when I woke up in ICU and realized I wasn't dead, my first thought was, F you, God, you know. Like, I knew it was God's fault, you know. And that's what it took, though. That's what had to happen to me for me to, you know, resign the debating club or, you know, quit you know, just to sit. And I don't even know, I could say listen, but to like let you say what you were going to say, you know, that's what it took. And after I was medically cleared, today's one of those days where I'm like doing this a lot. That happens sometimes. I don't get in the way. So I was moved up to the 6th floor at Olive View Hospital. And that was the psych ward. And I remember getting up there and getting to the payphone and calling my dad and being like, you know, you have to come get me. I don't belong here. These people are crazy. And all I heard was click, you know, and a voice in my head, which today I know was God because it never would have come from me, said, you know, you did this. You made your bed, now you lie in it. And for the first time in my life, I took responsibility for my actions, and I, you know, stayed there on the 6th floor at Olive View. And I was there for 10 days, not because I was any crazier than anyone else, but because I had no place to go, my parents were done. And so there was the social worker, his name was Caesar, and I remember he always used to... I always used to complain because he wanted to talk to me, and I was like, why does he want to talk to me? And he was trying to find me a place to go, so I wouldn't have to live on the psych ward. And, one day he said, well, I found a couple of rehabs, you know, there's this place in Santa Monica and there's this place in Sylmar. And I said, well, I want to go to Santa Monica because I like the beach and I like surfers and, there's a 2-story anthropology. And I was, you know, in full flight from reality. I was at a county hospital. I had no insurance, I had no money, I had nothing. And I'm like, I want to shop at Anthropology and live at the beach. And God was working in my life again before I acknowledged him or allowed him to, because that place didn't have a bed that day. But this other place in Sylmar, which was the town I was already in, did have a bed. And I just said, you know, I just want to get out of there because you couldn't smoke. And I said, fine, I'll go to this place, you know, in Sylmar. And it was a 6-month all-women's recovery home in Sylmar. And that's where my life changed. And I remember getting to the gate of that place, and I'll never forget how it felt, you know, when I got to the gate. This woman ran up to the gate, and she's like, hi, I'm your big sister, we're gonna love you till you love yourself. And I was just like, whatever, you know. I felt like taking those pills was the last idea I had, you know. It was the last, I had nothing after that, you know. I felt like God wouldn't let me die. That this was my punishment, you know, this was my penance, you know, like, and so it was like, that's how I showed up there, like, fine, whatever, you're my big sister, I live here. And that's how I showed up at my home group, you know. They brought me to this place that would become my home group, and everyone was so welcoming and loving, and I just was like, whatever, you know, like, I'm here because I didn't die, you know, like, just know that, you know. And they were so patient and loving, you know, because it took me a while. It took me a while to want to be here, you know. It really did. My saving grace was that, you know, I had burned every bridge. I knew I didn't have, like, street smarts. There they are again. So I had to stay at this place, you know, and thank God for that place. They were like, you know, here we do Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't like it, you can kick rocks, you know. And they called it Kicking Rocks on Polk Street because the house was on Polk Street. And I would picture myself, like, leaving and, like, literally kicking rocks, you know. I didn't have 35 cents at the time to put in a payphone to, and I didn't have anyone I could call, you know. So I had to be at this place, and to stay there, you know, I had to get a sponsor. We would have these meetings at, you know, every week, and we'd have to say, like, you know, so-and-so is my sponsor, and I called her, you know, every day this week, and I've done steps 1, 2, 3, you know, 4, whatever, you know, and I had to, like, report. And so, and I had nothing to lose, you know. And my sponsor, you know, that same big sister, who was going to love me till I love myself, like, introduced me to my sponsor. And she was like, why don't you ask her to be your sponsor? And my sponsor was like, yeah, I'll be your sponsor. My memory of, like, Alcoholics Anonymous people early was that, like, everyone was so happy, you know. And I picked her, you know, like, and now I'm that person, you know. which is fine, but I'm always attracted to, like, the new person who's, like, rolling their eyes, because that was me. And then I, like, hit them with all the, like, which is probably so annoying. But, yeah, so I asked her to be my sponsor, and it just, it started so simple, you know. She was like, I know you don't know me, just call me, get in the habit of calling me, and be like, you know, hi, I'm calling you. And that's what I did. I would call her and say, I'm calling you, and hang up, you know, and I would do that. So that I could have to report, because if I was anything, I was, I've always been a good student. I always wanted to have my assignments done, you know, so I wasn't going to look bad with all those other girls that I was so, like, oh my God. I remember calling my sponsor, early on and being like, oh my God, Karen, there are hookers here. And she was like, so what have you done, Clint? You know, and like, I'm so grateful for people like my sponsor and Barney and Anjanae who ran that house, who like weren't afraid, you know, who cared enough about my life to tell me the truth, you know. And they told me things like I was a taker, you know, and I remember, you know, when I was new, I guess the only thing I had to cling to was the fact that I had graduated from college, you know, so I guess I threw that around, because I remember them sitting me down and being like, oh, you went to college? Oh, you graduated Phi Beta, whatever, how's that working out for you? You know, and I was like, I tried to kill myself, you know, so it was little things like that, you know, and it wasn't, you know, it was just truth. I love in the big book, where it talks, at the end of one of those chapters, it talks about swallowing chunks of truth about yourself, you know? And I think about, you know, I have kids. I think about that song, like, you know, Great Green Globs of Greasy Grammy Gopher Guts, Tops of Dirty Birdie Feet, you know? And like, that's how it felt, you know? That's how, all that truth. But it was necessary, you know? And that inventory, that truth that was so, you know, globs of greasy, grimy gopher guts, you know? It was necessary that I get it out, you know, that I come face to face with it. And when I think about how transformative, you know, that process was, and I think about, like, what was I so afraid of? You know, I was so, I thought that facing those things, you know, that inventory stuff, like what I had done, the secrets that I was going to take to the grave, the things that made me the most disgusting human on earth, you know, the freedom that came from just saying it, and then later on, like, being able to verbalize or acknowledge or admit or see or say, like, yeah, I'm jealous of her, you know, just like that little thing, like, those were the things that I thought would kill me. You know, I couldn't come face to face with that. I couldn't say, you know, I got hired as a nanny and drove drunk with someone else's kids, you know? And I got to share that with another woman, you know? And the big thing, which I won't share here, the big thing, I called it the bomb, you know, was the thing that I hated myself the most for, you know? I gave it to my sponsor in our inventory, and her reaction was like, oh, so? I know a bunch of people that did that. You know, and I could breathe, and I remember after that inventory going back to the house and, you know, sitting on the lawn and doing steps 6 and 7, and that is when I committed, you know, like that 7-step prayer, you know, my creator, you know, take all of me, good and bad, you know. It's the first time I ever felt close to the God that I started a relationship with, the same way I started that relationship with my sponsor. Like, they told me to pray, and I was like, I'm praying, you know, like, and it turned into something. It turned into, like, sharing, you know, that relationship with my sponsor and the man who would be my spiritual advisor. Those two people on earth knew everything about me, you know, and the freedom that came with that and the intimacy that comes with that, you know, that those people love me no matter what, you know. And that's what my relationship with God became, you know, that I could share myself with God through walking through stuff that was hard and uncomfortable and disappointing in sobriety, because there's a lot of that. And I'm grateful for the people that told me the truth, that didn't promise me that stuff wouldn't happen, you know, like, they didn't say, like, oh, you won't get fired or dumped or, you know, lose people and have to put your pet to sleep and all the things, you know, the life things. I don't know where. I really have grown up up in Alcoholics Anonymous because I don't know, like, where I thought I could just show up and, you know, I'm saying, like, I'm Amy, take care of me, you know, do this for me. I don't ever want to feel bad. Like, where did I ever get the notion that I shouldn't feel bad, you know? And I've learned how to feel bad. I've learned how to survive sadness, you know, and survive. I've been unemployed twice in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I have two master's degrees that I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've still been unemployed, you know, and I survived it. I stayed sober. I kept my sanity. I'll say real quick, I have like 6 minutes. My first sponsor was really big on foundation, and she told me the story of the three little pigs, and she said, you know, you can build your house with straw, you can build it with sticks, or you can build it with bricks. Because one day the big bad wolf will come and blow your house down. And through no decision of mine, and this is where, you know, I conceive of God's grace, because none of the things that I did to get me where I am today were decisions that I made, you know. So I stayed at that recovery home for 6 months. I went on staff there for 9 months. I didn't want to do that, but I had no other options. Then I went to their sober living for a year, which I also didn't want to do, but I had no other options. I wasn't employable, you know. I took the bus, and, you know, these girls would, like, complete the program with 6 months and go out into the world and shop and get jobs and get married and have babies, and I was all bitter because I was taking the bus and being of service, and I had, like, commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would call my sponsor, and I'd be like, you know, I'm taking the bus, I'm laying bricks, those pigs are having fun, you know? And she would say, like, what kind of sobriety do you want, Amy? And he was like, great. You know, so I just plugged away, and, you know, those women that I was jealous of, some are sober, some are not. They've come in and out. I've seen some of them lose those children that they had as a result of going out. Some of them are in jail, and quite a few of them are dead, you know, and they were young women. And thank God for good sponsorship. And the whole time I was laying these bricks, you know, I thought God was withholding from me. You know, I thought it was still part of my punishment. You know, the first, like, 2-3 years of my sobriety, I thought God wasn't letting me have those things because I was so bad, you know, and I was, like, fine with it or whatever. And what I came to see is that I had this amazing gift, this blessing to learn how to live sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, to have Alcoholics Anonymous be the center of my life, and then I could build out from there. And that's what happened, you know. I got those things I wanted, but not in my time, you know. I got married when I was, oh my gosh, 6 years sober. 6 years sober. You know, I had my first kid when I was 9 years sober. I had my second kid when I was 11 years sober. And I'll say this. When my husband and I were wanting to have a kid, it took a long time, you know, and I remember going through all those phases, you know, where I was angry, and my brain was like, any stupid, you know, she can get pregnant, you know, and I couldn't, you know, it wasn't happening for me. And then I went, you know, was sad about it, and every time I looked at that little stick, I was so sad and disappointed, you know, but I just kept going, and finally I was just like, fine, we'll just, you know, we won't have kids, we'll have like 6 dogs, and it'll be the same. And finally, you know, after a year and a half, we got pregnant, and let me tell you, when that kid, baby, came into our lives, oh my God, you know, we fought so much. We just, our relationship was tested, and I remember thinking, like, how do people stay married through this? This is, like, so hard. And, I mean, I think I had, in hindsight, a little, like, kind of postpartum, like, psychosis going on, but so it's probably harder for him. But and then, you know, that's just, you know, God knew we needed that time to lay the foundation of our marriage, you know, so that we could get through that. And because of that foundation, because Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'll hear it from his mouth next week, because Alcoholics Anonymous is so important in both of our lives, that is the foundation of our marriage. That is how we get through hard stuff, you know, because no one ever told me that, like, marriage, check, you know, that was going to be easy either. Being married is hard. Being in a committed relationship is hard. Being a parent is so hard, you know, and I've been at home with my kids like in this apartment since March of 2020. And I work full time. I'm grateful that I have a job that I can do from home. And I homeschool them, you know, because they're doing their classes since March. You know, we had a break for summer, which was amazing. I was like more bummed than anyone that like school is starting again. And their classes are in Spanish and I don't speak Spanish. So it's been very challenging. You know, my little one challenges me for sure. And I have to make a lot of amends and I have a lot of opportunities to look at myself and to grow and to be better. But you know, when they're getting on my nerves and they're telling me like how bad a job I'm doing or whatever, like my brain wants to be like, you don't even know how good you have it. You know, you don't know who I was. You don't know what I was like. And then, you know, and then I think, you know, thank God, you know, and they never have to know. If I stay committed to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I make, you know, if I continue to live this way of life, continue to practice these principles in all my affairs, try to get closer to that God of my understanding and to become more like him. You know, it's the simplest way for me to kind of imagine it is like, you know, to become like more other-centered than self-centered. And that's what, you know, that consciousness of God, you know, allows me to do steps 10, 11, and 12. You know, they don't ever have to know what it's like to have a drunk mom. And my sponsor was a drunk mom, and my grand sponsor was a drunk mom. And when I hear them speak, I feel so grateful, you know. My parents, who right before coronavirus were retired and traveling the world, you know, and they get to do that because of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I got them for their anniversary this really nice, like, map of the world with these little pins that they could put everywhere they went. And my dad mounted it in the hallway and got this beautiful light. And it was just every time I walked by it, I was so grateful, you know, and I didn't want any of this. I would rather have died than get sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not want to be a part of this. And God overrode me. You know, God is so merciful. That is God's grace in my life. You know, and when my daughter, I have a scar on my arm. She was like 2.5 years old because I used to also cut myself. She rubbed her little finger over that scar and she was like, mommy, ow. You know, and that's what I think of when I think of what Alcoholics Anonymous can do. You know, the miracle of this program, that I could go from that to her little finger, you know. And so thank you for listening to me. I went 1 minute over the time that I said I would stop. I hope you all come back to hear my husband next week. He's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you.